Welcome to On the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. Here, this is the spot where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Welcome home, brains. There's only one requirement to hang out on the edge, is that you open your big brain and close your small mind. Did you bring your thinking caps? It's time to put them on, because the conversation starts
Welcome to On the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. This is the place right here where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Today, we have the beautiful Paula Diaco, and she is going to be talking to us about writing. Now, I talk to a million authors. I'm an author myself. We want to talk about the do's, the don'ts, what's important, knowing someone's voice, what is a ghostwriter, what is their purpose, how to transition your text into possibly audio, and the value of having a writing coach and having someone that is in this space. Talk a little bit about copyright, you know, plagiarism, autobiographies, memoirs, a lot of things to talk about. A lot of you have books out there. And I also want to talk to you a teeny bit about publishing, because a publisher is not a marketer. And because you have someone that is able to publish your book, that's getting that piggy ready to take to market. But you still got to put them on the auction block. And you have to continuously sell that book through if you want to have a true number one bestseller and not just an ebook. So we have a lot to talk about. Let's get started. Hello, Paula. How are you, Ms. Diaco?
I am doing very well today, April. Thank you.
Well, you look beautiful. We're both trending in blue. That's a good energy. Nice and calm. Is that your wall painted blue back there?
It is. Don't you love it?
I do love it. You know, and what I've done, I always change my, you know, furniture around, or I change the paint. But I've moved back to white walls. Can you believe that? I had a big, bold, beautiful blue wall in my bedroom, and I had a big accent wall of red in the living room. But I moved back, I guess, because I'm going to change the color of the furniture. But it tells a lot about your character. It tells a lot about your warmth. You are a writer, and you are from a lineage of writers. Both of your parents were writers. Tell me a little bit about your experience with writing and how this color blue comforts you.
Oh, that's, I love that. I love putting those two things together. And I have loved blue since I was born, probably. To the chagrin of my mom, who is a poet and short story writer who loves autumn colors. I realized about 5 years ago that I love blue. So I'm just gonna bask in blue. And this blue is actually even brighter in person than it is on Zoom. But it makes me, it feels good to be looking at you and seeing that behind me. So
thank you.
My parents, writers, my dad's a retired journalist. Again, my mom is a short story writer and poet. So there were books, language discussions, book discussions, writing discussions in the home, you know, probably since before I was born. So I came out and I was starting to hear this all the time. My mom was lucky enough to have attended workshops with William Carlos Williams back in the day. And didn't even realize exactly who he was, but she thought he was a pretty interesting and good workshop leader. And so, you know, literature and everything was just the talk within the family. And several of us, I'm one of six children, became writers because we loved it. And I knew I wanted to be one of the cool kids, which is funny because the only cool kids I knew who write were my parents, but I wanted to be one of the cool kids who wrote. I wanted to be in that whole world of writing and talking about language and books because I love it so much.
You know, writing, well, English was a challenge for me because I was dyslexic. And it was hard. My parents didn't know what dyslexia was.
Sure.
Identify it. And in schools, children really have a challenge because they don't know. They've never done this before. Mm-hmm. They're developing a skill set, so they don't know that they're doing it wrong. They get bullied by the other kids that are super smart. It's a learning difference. It's not a disability. Yes. It's a learning difference. I'm 59 Correct. Years old and I still transpose letters.
Yep.
But your writing, I tell people all the time, it is paramount that you have a good editor. A good, because people are looking at you, judging you, feeling you, traveling with you through your text.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to find that one, that the preposition is not correct, the comma's not in the right place, the word is misspelled, and it diminishes what you have. So let's start with that. Good editing is so important in a book. I don't care if it's a pamphlet this big or if it's 900 pages. When you agree?
Yeah, I've written about that, actually. Good writers have great editors, I believe was probably one of the titles of a social media post. And I know great writers, and they would not send anything out in the world without a good edit. It, as it happens, my sister is a great editor. So when I have something really, really, really important, I send it to her, and I'm always astounded at how it comes back. And I thought, why didn't I think of that? Well, because I wrote it. But she saw something that could be improved. She improved it. And I'm always grateful for editors. They're an absolute necessity, and I love them.
So now you have the editor. So the editor in a book plays hand in hand. Also, we'll talk a little bit about ghostwriting. Because when you're writing someone else's story, their business text, you have to have a sense for who that person is. That's like me. I'm a cool African-American woman, 59. My editor understands me. She understands my snarkiness. She understands where I mean to be funny, where I'm using slang intentionally. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to really relate to that. Now, you do some ghostwriting work. Tell us a little bit about that experience and what's that like working with the author?
Yeah, it's really fun because where they struggle, I can help them by ghostwriting their work. The way you do it and the way you do it best is to record them, talk to them, interview them, which is part of the process. So I do interview them for each of the chapters of the book after we've come up with an outline, and I listen to how they talk, and then I edit their work. So ghostwriting is as much listening and doing some pretty heavy editing and going back and re-listening and then verifying, because sometimes transcripts come out a little wonky. They're not exactly what the person, they didn't exactly translate what the person said. And just being really cognizant of syntax, if nothing else. How do they construct a sentence? How snarky are they? Are they ironic a lot of the time? You don't want to remove that. Do they talk in metaphors? I happen to quite a bit. I use metaphor a lot and simile a lot. Mm-hmm. If somebody took it out, it would not be my voice any longer. I'm cheeky as well, and a bit snarky, and I want that to remain. That is me, and it's not meant to insult anyone, and usually it's self-deprecating anyway. So that's what a ghostwriter has to do, is really be attentive to who the person is and how they speak literally, but also the person behind it. What is the message that they are trying to provide in language that sounds like them? They have to be able to read it and say, yeah, that's me. That sounds like me.
And using a variety of words. Mm-hmm. I have guests that want to come on the show that want to use profanity.
Yeah.
Now, a couple of those words are my choice favorite words, but there's a time and a place. There's over 7 million words used now in the English language. It's so important that you take a word and you look in a thesaurus and see other words that you can use. You don't want to use the same word over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's boring. It shows a lack of character, I think. Mm-hmm. And also, brains, understand that because you may have a challenge with spelling or grammar, that does not diminish your intelligence. Mm-mm. But what raises your intelligence is a variety of words, a nice lexicon, and a way of really delivering that information to people, clear and concise. Would you agree?
Yeah, totally, 100%. I think curiosity is so important when you're a writer, about the language you use, about the content you use, about the industry that you're writing about, that you're in, and that you are purporting to be demonstrating your expertise in, right? And so you want to show that in your writing. I think it's not to make you look smarter. It's to make you, it demonstrates that you are smart and that you're willing to go the extra little bit that it takes to serve the reader. Because this reader is probably, if you're writing a business book, it could be a potential client or collaborator or another industry leader, and you're wanting to be the thought leader in that.
Right, industry. Right. And they will slice and dice you.
They will. Yes, they will.
Now, do you write all types, all genres of books? Everything from fiction to memoirs to autobiographies to business texts. What's your lane?
I don't work with people on their novels. I do help them and love to work with memoirists, which is like a novel, but it is nonfiction. It's a person's bit of their life, a segment of their life, or a topic, a very important topic within their life. But it uses storytelling techniques. So it's good that I know how to write fiction so that I can help them write the best memoir. But otherwise, it's nonfiction. It'll be how to memoir and memoir / inspirational, self-help, personal development. It could be a straight inspirational. It could be just a narrative nonfiction on a topic that they are an expert on. And I love helping them with nonfiction, but I myself write both nonfiction, but I write fiction, but I don't help people write novels.
Okay. Why?
I struggle with, it's really interesting. I've asked myself this quite a few times, and I think it's because my own story tends to then get involved with theirs, and I want to change their story, and I shouldn't be doing that. Mm-hmm. So I stay clear of it because it's their story. I want them to have their own story, and I'm always thinking in terms of the plot and the angle. I'm actually a pretty skilled fiction writer, but I don't want to overlay that on their own fiction. So I stay with the nonfiction because I've done a lot of nonfiction work, and I've edited and developmentally edited a lot of books, from trade type books to business books to corporate interior guides and manuals. So I stay with that, and I really love it.
My editor works with very heady technical individuals to mm-hmm. translate their work or their body of work into mainstream language. Because sure. they're in that space.
Yes.
That's a lot of work too, because you as the individual mm-hmm. have to do a lot of work, research. You have to understand what this person is trying to say, and you learn a lot. Isn't yes. that a challenge?
Yeah, it is a challenge for sure. And that's what I used to do in corporate communications, was to take, I'll never forget, I wrote a little piece on the Corian tabletop, countertop for kitchens and baths.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And basically translated the engineers and the scientists' documents into a usable how-to for a builder who may be buying it for someone's home and installing it. And it was a lot of asking them questions. What did this jargon mean? Then putting that into common language that a builder would understand and be able to, and to use the how-to. So, yeah.
One of my favorite genres of books is autobiographies. I mm-hmm. love to read somebody's story. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm reading Will Smith's book.
Oh, yeah. And yeah.
It is so layered. It's so textured. You are transported to where he's been and his mindset.
Yeah.
It's very, very intricate. Do you spend a lot of time with the actual, I know you record them, but do you spend time also with these individuals as you help them write their stories?
Yeah, I do. I probably, this is going to sound odd, but I spend a lot of time with my clients who are writing memoir, who I am coaching versus ghostwriting their work. We meet a lot over the course of a month, and I talk to them a lot about what stories they want to include, because it's really takes, I think, a profound amount of courage to write a memoir or autobiography, because you're telling everybody your stories that.
You got everybody all up in your business is what you
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And
you have to be open. You're very vulnerable. You know, it's totally. Very cathartic for a lot of people.
It is.
And it's leaving a legacy. Everyone wants to leave an imprint. My brother was in the music and entertainment industry, and he sang with some of the world's greats. And he's passed away now. And when I drive down the street and I hear his song on the radio, it just brings back so many memories. So people want these books.
They do.
And they write them for different reasons. Again, so if you're writing a book to be published, to go out into the mainstream, you have, well, let's dial back. Let's talk a little bit about a writing coach. And then we're going to talk about publishing. So what is the purpose and the value of working with a writing coach?
You actually mentioned a few, the catharsis, the vulnerability. Believe it or not, some people realize they need that vulnerability because their memoir, their story, their life stories have been tapping them on the shoulder for some time, and they realize it's time to finally address it, and they're willing to go there. And a coach does not write the work for them. A coach helps them get the work out themselves. So they are doing the writing. And that does give them opportunity to examine their life and their stories and which ones, again, they want to share and which ones are going to tell the story and from what angle, and knowing that perhaps family members are not going to be happy with them. And it's really kind of a big deal. So a coach is a guide, a mentor, the person that they can ask questions for around writing. But it's, I think I love it so much because it is, memoir is a story, and there's stories within the greater whole entire piece of it. And I'm getting to know these people on a pretty intimate level. A lot that they end up writing doesn't necessarily go into the book. And I know these people really, really well. Better than their psychologist, perhaps. Right. And it's just, I think, not to, you know, make it sound, I don't know, highfalutin or something, but it's kind of a sacred experience, frankly.
It is.
For me to be invited into their life like that, and to, I don't know, just to see where they've come from. I mean, I sighed just now because... I've had memoir clients who have overcome incredible.
I know. That's why I love autobiography. I mean, I'm looking at, and it was so strange that I'm looking at this, I'm reading this book right now, and I'm at those same locations that he was at that time.
Yeah.
Thinking about that, and it transports you. And, you know, reading and literacy is so important. People don't really understand even the relationship between literacy, reading, and mathematics. Because if you understand, it is a language.
Yes.
And if you understand the terms, I mean, you're going to add, subtract, multiply, and divide no matter what.
Right.
But if you understand the different terms, it's like putting the pieces of a puzzle together. Mm-hmm. Parents, really go back to the day of reading with your child.
Oh,
I see people read with, you know, they're reading with the child in the womb. And it just does so much. My daughter was dyslexic like I was. And the teacher wanted to label her and say that she had this, that, or the other. And I'm like, okay, well, let's see. None of that panned out to be true. What she did was she had a learning challenge and she would be distracted. The other kids would be very fluid in their reading. She would stumble. They would laugh. She would feel bad. She would withdraw. I put her in a special program. Cost me $42 an hour for tutoring, $42 an hour, but it was the best money I ever spent. When she really got to going, she read that 800-page Harry Potter book like it was nothing.
Yeah.
And now she is an avid reader.
Yeah. Yeah.
Audio. A lot of people are taking their text and wanting to put it into audio. Mm-hmm. Audio is because they don't have time, or should I say they don't make the time.
Yes.
To cuddle up with a book.
Yeah.
Because it's an intimate experience.
Yeah, it is.
I love it on a rainy day. Give me a cup of hot chocolate with a shot of Bailey's. A nice blanket, and I'm sitting there in front of the, you know, in front of the fire. Mm-hmm. And it's really relaxing. And some people are reading for information. Some people are reading for content. Some people are reading to be transported. So you have to set the mood. But with these audiobooks, everybody's coming out. And what I've noticed is that it's a different feel, but also the text is different a lot of times from going from print to audio. They kind of condense it and it gives it a different flavor. Do you have any experience with that?
I think three of my authors have gone on to create audiobook versions of their print books. And of course, I wasn't there when they did it, but they loved it and they are just coming out. So I haven't heard them. This is going to sound funny. I actually got Audible on one of my girlfriends recommended I do that. I thought I'm not reading quite enough books. Maybe if I do, I can't stand listening to books.
Really?
I do.
We were on a road trip and I told my husband, I said, oh, I got some great books. Let's, you know, plug them in. He said, no, he didn't want to do that.
Yeah. Maybe on a road trip, but I have ADHD. My admission right here. So unless it's a really great story, I have a very hard time focusing on it. Mm-hmm. And then I drift off and I'm daydreaming because what's going on in my head is more interesting than what's coming out of the speakers, right?
Right.
Which is a funny admission, but a book I can sink my teeth into and my mind goes with it. Just like I'm there and I'm creating all the scenes in my head. But for some reason, audio is a struggle for me.
Right.
Another neurodivergence.
Well, you know, it is what it is. And it's what you enjoy and you realize that.
Yeah.
You know, but again, yeah. I love the smell of a book. I love the texture of a book. But then let's be honest, the books pile up and they're sitting there looking at you. What do you do with them? You know, you have to repurpose them, share them with friends. Now, I'm a writer. If I find something that's fascinating, I underline in my book. I highlight in my book. You know, I want to refer back to that at a later time. But do I really always go back and reread the book? No, but I do find valuable information. And that helps me reiterate. You know, if there's certain words that I've never seen before, I like to explore that. Okay, so we talked a little bit about ghostwriting. We've talked about the importance of having a good editor. We've talked about the significance of memoir and knowing your client or the person that you're working with. Mm-hmm. And copyright. Copyright is so important, is to be able to get that ISBN number. Do you work with people understanding what copyright is? Not so much doing the actual thing, but understanding the importance of having that, because that's your body of work. That is your imprint. That is going to, that's your legacy.
Yes, it is. And just for listeners to know, I'm not an attorney. However, I have known people who have had their work stolen. And the benefit of copywriting, and let me just state right at the top of this, that your work is copyrighted the second you create it. The reason why you would submit a copy of your work to the Library of Congress, which is where you do that, is so that if someone were to take your work, you would have proof that you created it before they did, because it's date and time stamped when it's received by the Library of Congress and it's stored there. And therefore, it's proven that you had that work done on such and such a date. And if someone were to take it, and this includes courses, this includes all manner of written creative material.
But see, it's beyond that. It's audible.
Of course.
You know, it's music.
Yes.
It's, you know, patents and trademarks, all of that is so important to, you know, my brother has great music. we heard one of his songs that was in a commercial. Mm-hmm. And we did our due diligence, got an attorney, and got a lot of money. Because that was stolen. You didn't ask for permission. You had for permission. We could have worked something out.
Exactly. But,
you know, and plagiarism. People will not take the whole thing. They'll take bits and bites. Yes. I had that happen with my poetry. You know, I had someone create some lyrics to a potential song. The song didn't go anywhere. But I was like, that's me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have to be very careful with that. Giving up your intellectual property and giving up your rights.
Yeah.
If you just say, well, whatever, then, you know, the chips are going to fall where they may.
Yeah. I've had people say, well, it's going to get stolen anyway. Mm-hmm. And in some circumstances, in certain parts of the world where it's harder to discover that it's been, your book has been taken and it's being printed there and sold without you knowing about it. But I'm talking about in areas where you can research online and you know that someone has taken outright, you know, plagiarized your work, you know, and called it their own, that you can go after them. And people also don't understand that it's not a cheap thing to be sued for copyright infringement. It can cost a lot of money. And as you mentioned, if the people had contacted you and your brother about the music, they could have paid a licensing fee that would have protected everyone and would have cost relative to the suing of them a lot less money. And everyone would be happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the same thing. That's the same thing with any kind of thief. You know, you go into a bakery and you know, you steal a cookie versus you ask, oh, may I sample that? They might give you two or three. So brains, you know, it's better to ask.
It is, just always.
Take advantage.
Always.
Publishing. I don't think that you're a publisher, but I'm sure that you work with publishers because again, you're helping the author get that piggy to the market.
Yes, exactly.
Tell us and explain to my brains, what is the function and the role of a publisher?
Oh, it's huge and so incredibly helpful. There are people who self-publish their work for sure, which means they do copyright their material, their manuscript. They get the ISBN number. They hire someone to do the cover and interior layout and all of that. There's a lots and lots of bits and pieces that come to getting that book to market. But a publisher, if you're a traditional publisher, you will pitch them and they will do that work for you and it does not cost you anything and you will get royalties for that work. If you self-publish, you can use companies that will accept payment for them to do that work and then you will get royalties as well, but much higher royalties because you paid for that production up front, whereas the traditional publisher picked up that tab. So they get the book to market. And quite frankly, I mean, unless you really, really want to learn about publishing, and so you're going to self-publish your book, there's so much help out there. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to reinvent the wheel, again, unless you really feel like you have to do that, because there's just so many services available today that'll help you get your book to market, whether it's an Audible-only book, whether it's a zine versus a traditional book. There are actually zine publishers still today. And they.
What is a zine publisher?
A zine is a, I don't know when zines started being published, but they are, I should have looked up a definition before I even mentioned it. And I have some zines, but I can't grab them right now. But they are usually a book that is on a very specific topic. And in the past, a lot of them have been handmade and sold or passed out for next to nothing. But there are publishers who will take them and only publish on, let's say, urban farming. So you live in the suburbs and they're going to have all how to have chickens in your backyard.
So they're pretty genre specific.
very genre specific they tend to be, and they're a little avant-garde. They're out of the mainstream, and that's the way they like it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that the books don't sell in great copies and great content and a number of copies. They can, and I'm not really defining a zine, but I'm just kind of describing some zines that I know of, and right, there are zines on how to publish and how to self-publish, so you could definitely, and there's lots of books on how to self-publish. There's tons of material on how to self-publish.
But well, I can attest to that. I can attest to that. I self-published 3 books, mm-hmm, and I've sold over 20,000 copies of those books out of the trunk of my car.
Yeah.
The hustle is real, brains. Okay.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
What I was refusing to give Amazon or other, you know, booksellers, I would have loved to have been in a Barnes and Noble or other retail bookstores, mm-hmm, but I was refusing to give them a dime because they take a large percentage. You have to worry about distribution, you know, the reviews, getting the reviews are very specific. They have certain guidelines and you want your numbers. It's very important. If you tell me that you are an author and I am vetting you to be a guest on my show, and I say, how many books did you sell? And you tell me, well, I don't know. Well, I'm less than impressed. Mm-hmm. But then you come back at me and you say, I am a number one bestseller. Well, newsflash, in some situations, that's a purchase of an algorithm.
Yes, exactly. Okay?
So mm-hmm, let's not pretend. I was called out by New York Times bestsellers, people that have sold millions of copies of books, that told me, well, honey, I went to get your guest book and it is an ebook. They have not sold anything in print. So I walk very gingerly when it comes to introducing an up and coming author. There's tons mm-hmm of words that you can use: up and coming, brilliant, breakthrough, riveting, mm-hmm, powerful. But to be number one, there can only be number one, only one in the race at a time. So mm-hmm you want to be careful because your credibility, a lot of times too, people get bored with their book. Oh, I've written a book and I'm on to my second book. You haven't had any traction on the first book.
Yes.
You have to learn how to sell your book. Mm-hmm. Online book parties, do a reading, an excerpt. Don't give them mm-hmm everything, but give them mm-hmm something to be excited about. Let them hear your voice. Donate your books to the public library. And remember, if you give your book out, it turns into a pamphlet a lot of times. If you sell your book, there is a vested interest. People have a buy-in. They know, mm-hmm, oh, I've paid $20 for this book or $25. At least I'm going to read 4 or 5 chapters. So it's very important, the sell-through of the book. Anthologies. That's very, very popular. People are now contributing to anthologies at a rapid pace, mm-hmm, but they get lost in the pages of those books. Mm-hmm. Again, they don't know how many books have been sold.
Right.
They don't know where they're being sold. They'll say, oh, I contributed to blah, 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 blah. But has anyone heard your voice? I mean, being on page 57 through 63 is a far cry from being at the beginning or the end of the book. So mm-hmm you have to promote that. How would you suggest that people really, you know, decide what type of anthology that they want to contribute to and, you know, being noticed in those type of books?
Yeah, I think if I were to, and I've been invited, as I think a lot of online coaches and consultants have, to participate in an anthology. I love your point about being the first or last chapter in the book. Is excellent. And so placement is good. I suspect it probably costs more to select where you're placed in the book because people who participate in anthologies are paying for that privilege of being in the anthology, at least the ones where I've been approached.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they think that it's just a, you know, a casual contribution. You're paying for that.
You're paying for it. Yeah, absolutely. So I would want to know the person who's putting it together. Where has he or she, and where are they going to be marketing this? To whom? Who is their audience for this? Are they my audience? Are they my potential clients? Are they my potential collaborators? How many copies are going to be sold? How many copies do I get to be able to market? What are they providing their authors in terms of marketing collateral so that they can, and are they giving them a little, some training? I have no idea because I've not participated in an anthology at all, but this is what I would be asking them. Are they going to show me how best to when it's launched, to be a participant that is getting the word out? And are they providing me with the collateral to do that? So this is a business investment. I want to know that my investment is going far. I want to know that it's getting out there. And is it making good business sense to me? I think that those, I don't know, but I would bet those questions aren't being asked, much less answered.
Oh, well, they're excited. You know,
Yes, of course.
They've been extended an invitation to write a chapter or two chapters about their story.
Yes.
Period. And it costs you ..
Yeah.
And it's going to be a part of a collaboration .. But again, it gets old. People get bored with it. Mm-hmm. You don't promote it. Continue to support it. It is a part of your legacy.
Yes.
It is your first original body of work.
Right.
Hopefully that the person with the anthology has a good editor and that editor contacts you so that they understand your voice. You know, don't just be involved in anything. Make sure it's in alignment with your values, with your truth, how much you want to expose. All these things are a lot to consider before you make that investment. And print on demand. That's my suggestion. I've got a friend right now, bless her heart. She's got 1,000 books in her garage looking at her.
Yeah.
1,000.
Right.
And now it's old. And now she said, oh, well, I'm just going to get rid of them and just write it off as a business loss.
Oh, that's a shame.
It is a shame. And I told her, I said, you know what? They do relaunches all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Get excited about what you've done. Reread it. Listen to your story. Yes. I wrote one story and I was very fortunate. A company bought 10,000 copies of that book. And when I say out the trunk of my car, baby, you should have seen me packing them books up and getting them to FedEx as quick as I could.
Yeah.
So exciting. So now the book is out of print, but I went back and reread it. And I was like, oh, wow, I could do a much better job. I could flavor this. I could extract this. This has happened.
Exactly.
So again, you can use it as a template and rewrite it. The new the next edition.
It's and called the second edition.
Second edition. And what I can do is easily probably sell 12,000 of those if I got 10,000 first.
Absolutely.
So it's exciting. Let's ask you some fun questions.
Okay.
Okay. What is the last book you read?
The last book I read was actually a novel by, you're going to ask me and now you could put me on the spot.
Of course, of course.
Now I'm not going to remember. It was by Louise Erdrich and it's one of her earlier books called, I want to say Beat Medicine. And again, I'm wanting also to stand up and go grab it, but I'm not going to do that. But it was
all right, go grab it. Let's go see. I want to see.
Right, hold on.
We got time. I love it when my brains not only talk the talk, but they walk the walk because they're helping you to do something. And you want to see what's pouring into them brains. You want to see how they're stimulating their brain, how they are constructing and benefiting from the writings of others, how they are enhancing their vocabulary, their lexicon, how they're shaping and designing. And that's what you do. You get inspiration from other people's writings. Absolutely. All right.
I could not find it, but I'll tell you of another one. This is not a novel. It's a wonderful book called Poem Crazy. It's been out for decades, and it is a beautiful book that brings you into poetry in a way that works for you. So you don't have to be a poet. And she isn't training you on, you know, it's not an academic, this is how poetry, these are the forms of poetry. Right. It's more bringing you in and letting you play with words and language. And it's a book that I give away as a gift that I highly recommend you pick up. It's a skinny little book, Poem Crazy. And it's a beautiful way to get creative and have fun with words and language. And I even have the little notebook, again, I can't reach it, but of the work that I've done using her exercises. And it's just wonderful. It's a wonderful book.
Well, that's great, because I'm a poet and yeah. I always am looking for inspiration in other individuals' writing. Mm-hmm. I'm a slam poet. I like to talk about reality. I like to talk about history. I like to talk about politics, adversity, overcoming, and just some whimsical things too. Yeah. So I always have my notebook handy. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's ask you some other fun questions. When you wrote your first book as a child, what was your inspiration?
Oh, okay. So this was a very dramatic event. I was 6, maybe 7. I literally, when I could first start to write, wrote this. And we lived in Northern New Jersey, and my parents took us to the Bronx Zoo. And this is a long time ago, okay, when zoos were not as good as they are today. They were mostly concrete, and the animals were in barred cages. It was really not at all helpful to them, the animals at all. So we're standing, it's a very hot day, it's July, it's in New Jersey, very hot and sticky, and we're at the Bronx Zoo, and we're all looking at this very large panther in a long, but kind of skinny relative to the panther cage with bars. And it's stressed because it's hot and it's humid, and a million people are looking at it and they're making noise, and it's in a barbaric situation. It's really not in anything that's appropriate for a large cat. And my family was talking about that. And I loved animals and I loved cats. I just gotten my first cat. And I was totally destroyed seeing that cat suffering in that cage. It really was painful. It was big. It was exciting to see a big cat, but not under that situation. I went home, that had such an effect on me. I went home and wrote a story about that cat. But in my story, I got the cat out and it went and lived with a nice neighbor down the road from the zoo. And but I named it Pansy because pansies were my favorite flower. Everything about this is so 7-year-old.
And that's what we need to get back to, the 7-year-old.
So yeah, exactly. Exactly. You
know, whimsical, being fun and laughing, mm-hmm. using your imagination, all of that's so important. So I think that's a beautiful story.
Yeah, thank you.
So your parents had it bounded and printed it for you?
They did not. I wrote it on newsprint paper that my father brought home from his, he was a reporter at a newspaper, the Bergen Record. And I held it together with, get this, a safety pin up in the corner. Wow. I stuck it with a safety pin. I would give anything to have that today. And I tried. I argued like a lawyer with my dad about him publishing it in the newspaper. And he said, but it's really not the sort of thing that goes into newspapers. And I couldn't understand why no one would want to know about this poor cat in the Bronx Zoo suffering.
I know. Right? That's a sweet story. That is really a sweet story. So what would you tell a person right now that is ready to take that leap of faith? They have this book in the back of their mind. They have it in a 3-ring binder. What would you tell them to get them jump-started and excited about publishing a novel or a business textbook, but putting their words to paper?
I would tell them that there's help and help has arrived. and that they, if they are feeling at all vulnerable or inept or incompetent or doubtful or frightened, which is all very common things that they may feel, that there are people who can help them, that there are coaches available who can help them. If it's really hard for them to write, talk about ghostwriting it. And then the process is more of them telling the story and then getting back written pages. But really that it's actually a good thing that there is some tentativeness about writing, because it means that it means a great deal to them. And I want to work with people who have an emotional component when it comes to their book. I don't care if it's a how-to book on how to grow pansies. Like they are really like very serious about it. And it has a heartfelt reason for being out in the world. I want to work with people like that because their stories are the best. They talk with passion. They get me excited about it. I do my best work with them because I see their passion, and then I'm revved up with passion for their project. And it makes for a beautiful, beautiful partnership to get them going. And it's okay that they're scared. Once they start seeing progress, it's exciting. It's so exciting. And then exactly. They want to continue.
Exactly. And I'm telling you, and then once that person purchases it, you just fall out.
Yeah.
You bleed out like a vampire has hit you. You're so excited. Oh my God, people are really interested. They've made an investment, mm-hmm. rather it be $5.99 or $29.99.
Right.
You know, there was an exchange of energy, and that energy was money, and it showed value in what you were doing. Yes. You are so powerful, Paula. Thank you so much. We have covered everything from page to page, from cover to cover. About publishing, there's so much more, Brains, that you can go in and do some deep diving, do some work with experts like Paula. She's the business. She's dedicated her life. And you know what the best part about it is, Brains? She loves what she's doing.
I do.
It's different when you have someone that's doing it for a job, but it's different in a different kind of way when people are doing it because they love it. Do you have any group programs? Do you do like any online, maybe, group coaching sessions?
I'm so glad you asked. I am actually planning on one. It is not launching until this spring, but people can reach out to me on Facebook or LinkedIn, send me a DM I'm Paula Diaco on Facebook and I'm Paula Diaco on LinkedIn. You can search for me there, send me a DM if you want to be on the list. It is going to be a book writing program, 4 months long. It's going to be about writing your nonfiction book, and I've got great plans for it. So yeah, I would love to, anybody who's interested can inquire with me.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited about that because I'm writing my fourth book, and, it's interesting. Again, I'm just putting, pen to pad right now. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing, Brains, is so cathartic. Use a pen. Well, this is a pencil, but use a pen and piece of paper and write it. It's something about the fluidity of coming from your brain, mm-hmm. through your arm onto the paper, looking at it, drawing lines through it, rewriting it. You can always type it. You can always record it. But there's something about putting pen to pad that elevates your writing to the next level. And you are the next level. Thank you so much, Paula, for being here on The Edge. Come back. Keep me posted. Let me know what's going on. Brains, work with her. Everybody's saying they got a book, but we want to know, do you really have a book inside of you?
Thanks, April.
All right. Bye, Brains. Have an amazing day.